Chapter 5 Shark Delight. Pelican's crew stood nervously before the rail, the shark-infested waters at their backs. Waters bloody red once more as Pelican's Knolls had been summarily thrown overboard. The remaining pirates had no weapons. Their wizards had their fingers tied together, and a crew of drows stood before them, hand crossbows and swords at the ready. And among those armed guards stood the drow warrior who had destroyed their powerful Captain Arango, a leader who had held them in thrall and in fear for a long time. They shuffled nervously as the drow leader in the outrageous hat began his review, accompanied by a drow woman dressed in the formal robes of a priestess. "This is my friend, one I trust dearly," Jarlaxle told them. "She is not young, certainly not so by the reckoning of a human, and she has spent more years than any among you have been alive studying the divine domain of knowledge. Part of that, well, you will see." He looked to Dabney, and she nodded. Jarlaxle's claim about her was no false boast, for though she had been raised as a priestess in the service of Lolth, her studies had always been more along the lines of the domain of knowledge. She had been the eyes of her old house, and while other priestesses around her were focusing on the magic of duplicity and disguise, the divine domains of trickery or tempest or war, Dabney's most important duties had been to uncover such subterfuge from potential rivals or enemies. So that's what she was going to do now. She lifted her holy symbol and began to chant under her breath, bringing forth her magic, opening the minds of these prisoners that they could not hide behind false words. Jarlaxle began to slowly walk the line of prisoners. "I ask you all," he told them, "to consider which among you tortured prisoners on behalf of Captain Arango." He stopped at the first, a panicked young man, and glanced back at Dabney. She studied the young man for just a moment, then shook her head. Jarlaxle clutched the man by the front of his shirt and tugged him away from the rail, sending him scrabbling to the middle of the deck. A pair of drow grabbed him there and brought him to the far rail. So it went down the line, Jarlaxle repeating his request. They couldn't help but hear it and react to it. They needn't speak an answer aloud, for just hearing the question in their minds brought forth the memories and thoughts, the nonverbal tics and other physical indications. Observing them and in their minds was Dabney, not like Kimuriel might have done, but enough to confidently nod or shake her head to Jarlaxle's questioning gaze. Though she believed less guilty got the head shake and were dispatched to the guarding drow. Those whose thoughts made Dabney know that they partook in the torture with relish remained where they were. All but five of the Pelican's 24 captured pirates remained at the rail. When he was done, Jarlaxle tipped his hat to Dabney, who went to the hatch and lifted the door, helping the pirates' captives out onto the deck. She led them to Jarlaxle. "Any in particular?" he asked them. For a bit, none of the poor souls dared to answer, but finally one young man, barely more than a boy, lifted a shaking arm and pointed to a filthy fellow standing halfway down the line. Jarlaxle walked up to him and paused, looked back at the boy, and pointed to the pirate. The boy nodded. Two other victims did as well. Jarlaxle pushed the man over the rail. He was still screaming and thrashing when the next torturer was identified, then a third, then two more. Over they went, all five, to the delight of the sharks. "It's not so much fun when it's someone you know, is it?" Jarlaxle said to the remaining pirates. "And less still when you know that you might well be next. And you might, any of you. I make no promises except to tell you that I am of an open mind on letting you live. You will work, untangling the ships, and making Pelican seaworthy that we can sail her back to Luskin. And you will be judged from now until we arrive. One mistake, one threat, one attack, and you will join Captain Arango and the others in the bellies of sharks." He stepped to the rail and looked over. Although I would guess that Captain Arango has found several new homes, at least, within which he can digest what he has done. He spun back with the pun, staring at Zacnafane and Intreri, holding his hands up in surprise that they were not laughing. "What?" he said innocently. The other two just walked away. The ships were separated in short order. It helped that Dudermont's Revenge was designed and built for ramming, tangling, and quickly extracting, and for fast repair. So by the time the captured pirates, laboring under the watchful eyes and commands of Bregan de Earth and a Revenge engineer, had untangled the lines of the fallen mast on Pelican, Revenge's sails were back in place and ready to catch the wind. It took another 2 days to get Pelican able to sail, and even then it would be with a noticeable limp, as Jarlaxle put it, but sail they did, straight back to the east, Dudermont's Revenge nearby, both running protection from other pirates that might be about, and reminding those captured Pelican crew that any resistance would be met with an overwhelming, and now merciless, response. Jarlaxle, Zack, and Intreri all remained on Pelican, something surely not lost on the captured pirates. They would never regain this ship, let alone manage to somehow outrun and evade Revenge. "You are a crew. My crew now," Jarlaxle told them repeatedly as he walked the deck. "I'll feed you well and keep you well as long as you do as I say. Those sharks following us? They are my sharks, my pets, and I promised them that I would feed them well if you don't." "He's the blustering one," Zack said to Intreri, the two sitting against the rail, inspecting their weapons and taking a meal.
"The Conqueror, ever adding to his collection of assets," Intreri replied.
"Assets?" Zack asked, shaking his head.
"I don't know this word."
"His treasure, don't you see?" said Intreri.
"They, we two, breaking the earth,
Luskin itself.
We're all Jarlaxle's treasure.
He's like a dragon, but he hoards people and power instead of gold and gems."
"And dragons themselves," Zack quipped. "Two of the strangest worms I've ever heard tell of. Where are Taz Mikella and Ilnazara, I wonder? They'd make this pirate hunting a lot easier, on my stomach at least."
"They flew back to Vasa, I was told. But I'm sure that we'll see them again. Jarlaxle's not one to let that kind of power evade him for long."
He noticed that Zack was looking at him with some suspicion then.
So Intreri lowered Karen's claw across his lap and turned to meet the weapon master's gaze. "You speak of him as a villain, yet you remain by his side."
"Hardly a villain," Intreri replied.
"He hoards people?"
"Aye, because they want to be there," said Intreri, following Zack's gaze to Jarlaxle, who was approaching. "That's his charm, don't you see? He understands the concept of creating situations that both sides will appreciate, understanding the mutual benefit. That's why he'll have Luskin fully for as long as he wants it, because the folk of Luskin will want him to have the city. If the kings and queens of the world spend as much time and gold on caring for those they rule as they do on armies and weapons they keep ready in case those people rise up against them, they'd be richer and more secure by far." Zack snorted. "You would have a hard time convincing the matrons of Menzo Berenzon of that, I fear."
"Do you think the dwarves would ever rise up against King Brunner?"
Intreri finished the conversation as Jarlaxle arrived. And Zacnafane knew it to be a rhetorical question anyway, or at least one with an obvious answer.
"I'm losing my voice from so much talking and assurances," Jarlaxle said.
"Do you think, perhaps, that either of you might muster the strength to walk the deck and coax the crew?"
"I could, but I don't want to," Zack replied.
"You bluff, Jarlaxle,"
Intreri added.
"Both of us know you well enough to know that the one thing you could never lose is your voice."
That brought a smile to Jarlaxle's face, and he bowed in surrender and swept his arm gracefully. Intreri noted that Jarlaxle was wearing a couple of rings that he had seen on the hand of Captain Arango, and not the hand Zacnafane had severed and left on the deck. He looked from the rings to Jarlaxle's waiting and knowing smile. I took what I could find, the drow rogue explained. Fortunately, the giant shark was no longer hungry. But less fortunately, it is almost certain that greater treasures were among the contents of its belly.
You disappoint me, Zack told him. I would have thought you the type to follow the beastly shark until it shat out the rest of Arongo.
It was a thought, Jarlaxle replied, walking away. Zack looked to Entreri, who could only shrug and admit,
I didn't even see him get wet.
Soon after, the lookout called down, Land! And as the sun set behind Pelican, it shone past them to the tips of tall, snow-covered mountains far ahead and to the left. And when it went into hiding behind the sea, the stars came twinkling to life above them, and so too did the lights of Luskin sparkle, far away and straight ahead.
Have you discovered more? Jarlaxle asked Catti Bree a few days later in Gontalgrim.
I believe that I know as much about the whip as I'll ever learn, she replied. I have spoken with great wizards, even creatures of other planes, even with Megara, to a degree, if our communions can be considered a dialogue.
She shrugged and admitted, though I'm not sure how much of the full story or power that may be, nor even where fact ends and supposition begins.
But you're comfortable with the attempt?
The woman shrugged again.
I have little idea of how the flames of the primordial will treat the weapons, though I am more confident now that Megara will not be able to use the powers of the whip to somehow escape its chasm. The only loss I foresee would be that of the whip, and whatever else we feed to the great forge.
Splendid, Jarlaxle said, and clapped his hands, then reached toward his left hip.
Catti Bree fully took note of the sword hanging there for the first time, and though the pommel was different, she surely recognized the hilt and crossguard. She gasped and grabbed Jarlaxle by the forearm.
No, never.
Jarlaxle turned a perplexed look her way.
I will not add magic to that sword, she explained. Never. I'll not feed it into the great forge. But I would gladly, no payment needed, throw it into the primordial chasm to be destroyed, or otherwise removed from the hands of its next victim.
Ah, you recognized Kazideya, Jarlaxle replied.
And our conversation is at an end, she said and started away.
No, lady, no, Jarlaxle said, stopping her before she had fully turned from him. I do not wish you to feed Kazideya in with the whip. The sword is magnificent on its own, of course.
You're a fool for even wielding it.
I carry it, Jarlaxle told her, sheathed. I do not wield it.
Destroy it, then, and make the world a better place.
It is a powerful tool, and in the right hands.
Her narrow-eyed look stopped him for a moment, but only a moment.
Kazideya allowed Driz to fight Obul to a draw, he reminded her. It is just a sword.
I know all about that sword.
You do, and my apologies for bringing it here this day, the drow said with a bow. But I repeat, it is not Kazideya I wish you to feed to the forge beside the whip.
He reached to his hip again, but under Kazideya, bringing forth a beautiful small sculpture of a yellow and orange fiery bird, which she recognized as a phoenix. After a moment, she realized that it was more than a sculpture. It was a long sword hilt, but one missing a blade. The wings of the bird were out to its sides, serving as a crossguard, and with the outer feathers bending back toward the pommel to form a solid guard, the long neck snaked up higher, and Catti Bree thought that it was blocking the butt to which a blade might be attached. But no, she realized, there was no attachment prong, nor a hollow into which a blade might be fed and secured. She looked at the tiny rubies that served as eyes for the bird, and a third, larger red gem set in the pommel, which seemed to be formed of the bird's tail feathers curled up into a ball.
That? She asked. Why that? The whip has a handle.
And the hilt has a blade, Jarlaxle explained,
and he lifted it and tightened his grip.
The three rubies flared with inner magic, and the blade of light suddenly appeared, accompanied by a momentary low hum.
"A sunblade," Catti Bree said. "I have heard of this. It is said to be a marvelous weapon."
"It is indeed, and one worthy of all but the greatest of warriors. Zaknafane took it from Captain Arongo and is anxious for it back. But I promised him that I would return to him something even more wondrous than Arongo's sword alone."
"You wish to risk that prize in the Primordial's fires?" she asked, her doubt showing.
"I wish to make this weapon worthy of the greatest of warriors," Jarl Axel reminded her. He rolled his wrist as he dismissed the blade of light, then handed the phoenix pommel over to Catti Bree. She took it and held it out before her gingerly for a while, staring blankly, trying to let it all properly register.
"Do it, I beg," Jarl Axel pleaded. "I believe this will complement well the Whip of Flames."
"Just give this to Zaknafane along with the whip," Catti Bree suggested. "He will be as powerfully armed as almost any warrior along the Sword Coast."
"I seek more than that. I wish it to be truly worthy of Zak. Do it."
"And if the result disappoints?"
"Then I have an excuse to find another adventure to replace what I have lost."
"You'll not find another whip like this," she warned.
"It is marvelous, but situational," Jarl Axel answered, "and next to useless when an enemy is close."
"Then Zak uses the sunblade."
"I wish him to have more options."
"You risk a lot."
"I like to bet," he said, and held his hand out toward the door that led toward the forge room of Gontalgrim. "But there's a difference between gambling and taking a risk. I rarely gamble."
Catti Bree took up the whip in one hand, the phoenix hilt in the other, and paused, but only for a moment. She shrugged and started off, glad that Jarl Axel was behind her, for she didn't want him to see that she was truly intrigued. They said nothing until they got to the Great Forge. The forge room was mostly empty at that late hour, though one fellow worked at a small oven across the way, hammering at some tool. Catti Bree fast approached and unintentionally startled him when she called to him, so much so that he nearly dropped his tongs and the hot metal he held with them.
"Aye, princess," he replied, setting down his instruments and pulling off his protective mask. "What might I be doing for ye?"
"Festus, yes?" Catti Bree asked, recognizing the dwarf as one of the Adbar boys who had stayed on after the retaking of Gontalgrim.
"Aye, Festus Grimforge, at your service," he said with a bow.
Catti Bree looked at him curiously, trying to place the name.
"I'm not for knowing Clan Grimforge," she admitted. "Was Omal, lady," he explained. "Are they Adbar Omals?"
"Ambergris," Jarl Axel said.
"Fourth cousin," Festus said.
"Then why Grimforge?" asked Catti Bree.
"New clan under Battlehammer," Festus announced. "More and more joining. Ragged Dane started it, with the Queen's own sister, Hannah Britches Fellhammer. Aye, she and Ragged Dane will be taking Grimforge as their clan name when they marry later in the year. And they'll have a fine clan around them, what? Boys from Felbar and Adbar, from Mirabar, too."
"Just boys?" Jarl Axel quipped. "Sounds like a short-lived clan."
"Every dwarf is called that," Catti Bree replied. "Always their boys, and that's meaning all of them. It's a term of endearment and camaraderie, nothing more."
"Grimforge," she repeated, looking back at Festus.
"I like it. Like the new Grimguard. Seems fitting."
"Aye, that's what we were thinking."
"He chose well," Catti Bree said. "Might I ask you the favor of firing up the oven of the Great Forge, Festus Grimforge?"
The dwarf looked at her curiously.
"Are ye doing it again?"
he whispered after glancing all around to make sure they were alone.
Catti Bree knew what he meant, for the whispering hadn't stopped since she had combined Twinkle and Vidranath, and combined Brunner's shield with Orbcress, and her bow Tolmaril with a marvelous buckle that magically concealed weapons.
"Fire the forge and you'll see," Catti Bree promised.
It didn't take long before the oven of the great forge blazed white hot. They didn't have to feed it wood or coal or anything else, of course. All that they were doing was opening the appropriate valves, enough to let the primordial send forth a furious tendril of flame. The ovens were the real engineering and magical marvels here, strong and secure, with countering enchantments to prevent the beast's escape. And the largest and most impressive of all was that of the great forge. A wizard or priest detecting magic on it would be blinded as surely as if they stared into the white-hot flame within.
"You are sure?" Catti Bree asked one last time, when she stood beside Jarl Axel at the feed to the oven.
Jarl Axel nodded, and the woman lifted the beautiful hilt, examining its magic with her spells, and then the bullwhip, which she had already studied intently.
"Is it all up to the oven?" Jarl Axel asked.
Catti Bree shook her head, but was too deep in her thoughts to break them by answering aloud. She put the whip on the tray. She cast a spell of protection upon herself, bade Jarl Axel and Festus to back up, then opened the oven gate. She started to push the whip in closer, but even with her protective enchantment, the heat was too much for her. She turned to Festus and pointed, and the dwarf tossed her his gloves. She donned them and took up long-handled tongs. In went the whip, the flames roiling about it almost hungrily, then dancing about it as if joyously, as if they had found a long-lost cousin. The whip itself shed wisps of smoke in the heat, and threw shots of its own flame to dance with the primordial tendril.
"That doesn't look good," Jarl Axel remarked, but Catti Bree held up her hand to silence the drow, urging patience.
She lifted the blade of light, admiring the beautiful phoenix hilt and hoping that this artwork would not be melted to an ugly lump. She put it on the tray, but picked it back up immediately on a notion and called forth its blade.
"Well, looky there," she heard Festus say.
Onto the tray it went, and Catti Bree grabbed it with the tongs and placed it into the oven beside the whip. Then she shut the grate and began to chant, calling through her magical ring to Megara, asking the primordial to reveal its beautiful power of creation once more.
"Open the valves wider," she bade Festus.
"Lady," he said slowly and with obvious concern.
"Do it. It is okay."
It went on for a long while before Catti Bree at last bade Festus to shut down the oven. When she opened the grate, she saw only the small flame that never extinguished within, and it was dancing mesmerizingly, as if telling her to go ahead and remove the items and witness again the beauty and power of Megara. Catti Bree swallowed hard. The whip was gone. The blade of light was closed, but the phoenix hilt remained, apparently unscathed. She pulled it forth and lifted it. Feeling no heat, she removed a glove and gingerly brought her bare hand close, then grasped it and closed her eyes. A smile spread upon her face, and she nodded approvingly, then turned to Jarl Axel.
"I think you'll be pleased," she said, and tossed him the hilt.
He too closed his eyes, and Catti Bree knew that the new weapon was revealing to him its powers, as it had just done to her.
"Very," Jarl Axel said a moment later, his eyes widening.
"And so will the wielder."
"Ye gone to tell me then?" Festus asked. "What happened to that whip?"
"It's in there."
Festus leaned over and looked curiously into the open oven.
"Not in there. In the hilt,"
Catti Bree explained.
"Huh?"
"Do yourself a favor, friend," Catti Bree said. "Do not ever anger Zacnaphane to the point of battle."
"Ne'er occurred to me," the dwarf assured her.
"Would you leave us, good dwarf?" Jarl Axel then asked.
"Aye, but not for long. I've plenty the work to do."
"It won't take long," Jarl Axel promised. Festus bobbed his head and scurried along. He was barely out of the room when Jarl Axel again drew Kasidea.
"I already told you," Catti Bree scolded.
"I'll not put that infernal blade into the great forge."
"Of course not. And Festus is gone, and the oven is closed in any case. But I wonder, would Catti Bree be interested in forever defeating the threat of Kasidea, so that the sword will never again do to another what it did to her?
I will happily throw it into the chasm with Megara to be devoured." No, no, there is a better way, Jarlaxle assured her. And in this way that I have discovered, you might well save another of the sword's victims. It might well help me prevent the grand slaughter that will soon befall Menzo Berenzon.
Caddy Bree cocked her head, her blue eyes unblinking.
Take it, Jarlaxle bade her. Hold it, dominate it, demand of Cazidea that it tell you of another victim and point the way.
What madness is this?
No madness, good lady, never that. You know there is no risk here, for you are far beyond the willpower of Cazidea. Do as I ask and I will explain, or more likely do as I ask and you will come to understand all on your own.
Caddy Bree hesitated. She wiped her hand on the side of her breeches, then slowly lifted it toward Jarlaxle, toward Cazidea, flinching.